I'm speaking today with Professor Howard Pollack. He's a clinical professor of dentistry in the Department of Preventive and Restorative Dental Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. Professor Pollack, welcome to Naging Now.
Thanks for inviting me.
Dr. Pollack, you have some expertise in fluoride, and you've also written a fair bit about fluoride and the controversies around fluoride. Before we get into the controversies, I'd actually like you to explain to us the chemistry of fluoride. How does it actually prevent cavities and increase bone density?
Well, fluoride is a very interesting element. The element is actually fluorine, which is a gas. It's not a gas in nature. It doesn't exist naturally, but the fluoride ion certainly does. It's present in water, and that's the main source of fluoride since time began.
How does fluoride get into the water?
Well, fluoride is combined with other elements like calcium, magnesium, aluminum, phosphates in rocks in the ground. And as water percolates through the ground, it picks up those minerals. And so every water supply has a certain amount of calcium, certain amount of the other elements, and fluoride.
The water that naturally occurs in the ground has fluoride in it. It's leached out from rocks that are in the ground. Depending on where you live, you might have more fluoride in your water or less fluoride in your water or even no fluoride in your water.
That's correct. Unlikely to have no fluoride unless it's rainwater.
So all groundwater will have some fluoride in it.
That's correct. The studies that were done in the early 1900s in the United States and elsewhere were able to link the fluoride concentration in the drinking water with a couple of different things with regard to teeth. There was a problem with what was called endemic dental fluorosis. It's not called fluorosis at the time because they didn't know what caused it. It was called mottling of the teeth. Mottling is a change in the appearance of the teeth so that they have little white flecks on them or little striations. And with severe dental fluorosis, it could be stained from the things that we drink or eat. And there may, at very high levels, be pitting of the surface so that it's not smooth. The early studies were trying to find out what caused this. It happened in certain communities and not in other communities. And everybody seemed to have it in those particular communities. So it wasn't until the early 1930s that the technology developed to the point where very low concentrations of fluoride could be detected in water in parts per million, and found that at about one part per million, there was a minimum amount of dental mottling or dental fluorosis. But also, most interestingly, there was a minimum amount of tooth decay, which led to the development of the notion that, well, why can't we simulate or emulate that ideal environment in other communities? Why can't we adjust the fluoride concentration so that it's at that ideal one part per million? And that's how water fluoridation started.
How actually does fluoride prevent cavities? How does it actually work in the mouth or in the teeth or in the bones?
Well, looking at the surface of the teeth in people's mouths, they're often covered with dental plaque, the bacterial plaque that covers the tooth surface that you're trying to clean off when you brush and floss your teeth. There's a dynamic interchange across the tooth surface and the plaque with the calcium, the phosphates, the fluoride, and the other components of tooth material. The enamel surface is comprised mainly of a complex molecule called apatite.
Apatite?
The apatite that you get when you're hungry for lunch. This is spelled slightly differently.
A-P-A-T-I-T-E.
That's right. It's a combination of calcium, hydroxyl ions, carbonate, phosphate, and fluoride that makes the inorganic hard structure of the teeth. Enamel is the hardest substance in our body. It's much harder than bone, much harder than the dentine underneath the enamel of the tooth. It's amazingly resistant to breakdown.
Well, the enamel is the shell that covers the tooth.
It covers the crown of the tooth. As we get older, the roots of the teeth get exposed, and they're more susceptible to decay because they're not covered by enamel. Enamel is a wonderful substance.
And it's made up of calcium, phosphate, this apatite, fluoride, you mentioned hydroxyl groups, and carbonate.
Right. In the tooth decay process, we eat things that contain sugar or different kinds of carbohydrates. And the bacteria in our mouths can never be sterile. As Madonna said, Well, actually, she said it was a material world. I say it's a bacterial world.
Excellent. I see a song in the making.
There you go. So the bacteria consume the sugars that we put in our mouths and convert that very rapidly into acids of various kinds. And those acids can start to dissolve this very strong enamel apatite material. In that process, in that demineralization of the enamel, those minerals go from the enamel into the plaque. In the presence of fluoride, there's less of that.
Because?
Because the fluorapatite is just more acid resistant. In the presence of fluoride, the reverse occurs as well, that remineralization occurs. And that remineralized enamel is even more resistant to further breakdown by the acids. So in a fluoridated community, and if you're using a fluoride toothpaste twice a day is what we recommend, you're going to get less tooth decay.
Also, doesn't fluoride interfere with an enzyme in your saliva that is involved in breaking down enamel?
There's an enzyme called enolase or enolase. It's part of the composition of the bacteria. In the presence of fluoride and concentrated amounts of fluoride, there's an interference with that enzyme so that the bacteria can't produce the acid quite so readily and they can't reproduce quite as quickly.
Aha, so it interferes with an enzyme that the bacteria is producing.
It's part of their metabolism.
Part of their physiology. Do we have enolase in our system?
I have no idea.
Perfect.
So we do.
Is it possible that fluoride also could interfere with enzymes that our body makes?
Yes. The issue with any substance is dose or concentration. So, for instance, I mentioned that one part per million of fluoride in water is considered about an optimum amount. In the United States, toothpaste has about 1,000 parts per million, very concentrated, okay?
That's why you don't eat your toothpaste.
It's recommended that you don't eat it. You don't swallow it, you spit it out.
Although kids probably eat a fair amount, especially if it's like bubblegum flavored or something.
Absolutely correct. And that's one of the concerns we have is that in this country, we don't have a low fluoride toothpaste as there are in other countries. And we've recommended that only a smear or a pea-sized or a rice-sized amount of fluoride toothpaste be applied to very young children's toothbrushes by the parents. Very young children are very good at swallowing and not so good at spitting out. It's manufactured by the companies to be attractive, sweet, bright and colorful, and it's got all kinds of wonderful names. And
that's a lot of education and training and piece by piece, bit by bit, one person at a time. Isn't there a way we can just regulate the toothpaste companies so that they put a more appropriate child-friendly concentration of fluoride in their toothpaste?
We don't have a very good system. In Australia, they have half the concentration of fluoride in children's toothpaste.
We could just reduce the concentration for everyone too, right?
We could. The issue is, what is the evidence in terms of what works to prevent tooth decay? And certainly the evidence is very strong that the 1,000 or higher concentration of fluoride toothpaste, for instance, in England, they have 1,500 parts per million of fluoride. We used to have that product here. It doesn't exist here anymore. But there is even stronger fluoride concentration toothpaste that we can prescribe to individuals who are going to spit it out, who are particularly at risk for tooth decay. That's at 5,000 parts per million. The research shows that below 1,000 parts per million, it doesn't have a very strong preventive effect on tooth decay. So that 1,000 parts per million seems to be the level that the FDA is willing to approve based upon the studies, and that they would not be willing to give approval as a decay preventive if it was less than that. The toothpaste manufacturers in the United States are unwilling to go through the trials to demonstrate its effectiveness. The results so far outside of the United States are equivocal.
So we were talking about the dose makes the poison, basically, and whether fluoride interferes with enzymes that are naturally produced in our human bodies.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about that. The concentration, as I've mentioned, in water, one part per million, toothpaste, 1,000 parts per million. In our body, the concentration in the intercellular fluid and plasma is 1/100th of a part per million. So it's 0.01 or maybe 0.02. 0.03 parts per million of fluoride is in our bodies, except for our bones. Our bones pick up the fluoride So at that concentration, we don't find the effects that we see in the bacteria with enolase, for instance.
So how well is fluoride absorbed into the body when you eat it or drink it?
It's fairly well absorbed. It's a very small ion, and as long as it's bioavailable and not bound with calcium that might go straight through your system, about half or so of the fluoride that we take in, that from the water, tea, for instance, has high concentrations of fluoride. Various food items naturally have fluoride. And so about half of that would be excreted immediately. Half of it would be absorbed into our bodies. And of the part that's absorbed into our bodies, most of that is actually picked up by bone. And then some is excreted through urine. We talked earlier about different fluoride concentrations naturally occurring in our drinking water systems. There are some 200,000 people in the United States who live in a community where there's more than 4 parts per million of fluoride in the water. This is a level that the U.S. EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, considers the maximum amount that should be permitted. People in those communities that have more than 4 parts per million are advised not to use the waters for human consumption. For children, we don't want them to consume water if there's more than 2 parts per million in their water supply. And there are about 1 million people in the United States exposed to that level of fluoride naturally occurring. Particularly during the tooth development years, where the dental mottling is more prevalent.
On the one hand, the fluoride will decrease bacterial growth in the mouth, and that helps to prevent tooth decay. It also helps with remineralizing the enamel. So those are the benefits, the good actions of fluoride. On the other hand, it causes mottling of the teeth. How does it do that?
Well, the cells that produce enamel are called ameloblasts. During tooth development, before the teeth erupt or come into the mouth, the enamel is forming at a very young age. It's happening in utero during pregnancy for the baby teeth, primary teeth, and it's occurring at around birth and over the next 8 years in the permanent teeth. Some teeth erupt when you're 6 years of age. The wisdom teeth may not come in until you're 25. The critical time for the front teeth, where it's more obvious in terms of the appearance of those teeth, is around the first 3 years of life. If you're consuming excess fluoride during that time, either by high fluoride in the water, fluoride toothpaste, maybe in a non-fluoridated area, you're being prescribed fluoride supplements because there's not enough fluoride in the water, and that's recommended, particularly for children at high risk for tooth decay. There are problems with excess fluoride intake for some children. Those ameloblasts are very sensitive to the concentration of fluoride. During that maturation process, where they're picking up the calcium and the fluoride, if there's too much fluoride, it interferes with that process. If there's too much fluoride, the enamel doesn't form properly. It's actually been shown that this is hypomineralized, that there isn't sufficient mineral if there's a high level of fluoride. So then that surface can be a little porous. When it comes into the mouth, it can absorb stains, and it has different optical properties so that light doesn't reflect off it in the same way as a normally developed tooth. By and large, it's not a problem. 95% of dental fluorosis is hardly noticeable. You'd be able to see it if the teeth were dried in a certain dental light, and you could see these little white marks in the teeth. Interestingly, most children who grow up in an area where there's high fluoride will not only be exposed to that high fluoride during the tooth development period, but after the teeth come into the mouth. So then the high fluoride is actually very beneficial because it can help to remineralize those porous surfaces.
Interesting. So fluoride, it's very highly charged, negatively charged, right?
In fact, fluoride is the most electronegatively charged ion. It is like a super magnet. It's usually bound.
It binds with calcium sometimes.
Yes, calcium in nature, it could be with aluminum, could be with magnesium, any of the cations.
How does that impact bone? Because, I mean, bone is highly dependent on calcium for its structure.
Bone is very similar to tooth enamel and dentine. It has collagen matrix and it has the inorganic apatite. Bone is intimately connected to our tissue fluids. And so there's this ionic interchange from bone to our fluids. When we're growing, we're absorbing a lot of fluoride.
Calcium.
and calcium into the bones. As we get older, we're losing calcium and fluoride from the bone into our tissues. One method that has been used in the past for treatment of osteoporosis is actually to treat with much higher doses of fluoride in order to keep the calcium in the bone. And then the manufacturers of the many drugs that are available now to treat osteoporosis seem to take over, and the use of fluoride seem to wane.
It was effective.
It was effective in the treatment and the prevention of osteoporosis getting worse.
My understanding is that fluoride will increase bone density, but it also makes the bones more brittle.
Again, it's dose. There is a condition called skeletal fluorosis. There have been a few documented cases in the United States, and certainly many more in areas where there's very high natural fluoride in the water, greater than 4, greater than 8, greater than 10 parts per million of fluoride in the water. The Rift Valley, certain parts of India, China, where they also burn fluoride-containing heating fuel in homes that are not well ventilated, so it gets into the air so that you're breathing the fluoride as well.
Parts of India and China have very high concentrations of fluoride in the water.
Yes.
And so it's in the plants as well. And so they're often using plant-based fuels for home cooking and heating.
That's correct.
So then the fluoride goes back into the gaseous state, and then you're inhaling it and you're absorbing it through your lungs.
Yes, that's true. So skeletal fluorosis in this country is a fairly rare condition, and it's usually reportable. There have been a couple of cases, for instance, where somebody made iced tea, loved iced tea.
Drank gallons of it a day.
2 gallons a day with high fluoride in the water to start with.
Yeah, the tea plant loves to take up fluoride.
It does, and it seems to not affect the tea in terms of its taste or its ability to grow. And then there was another case where somebody, an adult, liked to brush his teeth 6 times a day with a lot of fluoride toothpaste and must have swallowed most of it. And as a result, developed skeletal fluorosis. Fortunately, most of that was reversible by eliminating the source of that high fluoride.
So what does it mean to have skeletal fluorosis? How do you feel it? How do you see it? What does it mean for your life?
Well, if it's severe, you can develop curvature in your spine, like some pains in your bones.
Fractures.
And fractures could increase. There was a review of fluoride in the drinking water by the National Research Council, published in 2006, and concluded that at the level of slightly more than 4 parts per million, there is a greater risk of bone fracture, particularly hip fracture, compared to 1 part per million. We feel pretty good that 1 part per million is safe and effective, and safe preventing fractures, effective preventing the dental fluorosis and the caries, tooth decay. And the EPA is considering whether or not to actually lower that 4 parts per million level as the maximum contaminant level of naturally occurring fluoride.
What is the concentration in parts of China and India where skeletal fluorosis and dental fluorosis are very, very common?
It's been documented at 11 parts per million and higher. There was a review recently of studies from China and Iran where the fluoride level was very high. There was concern about what effect does this have on development of our bodies, our systems, our nerves, our brains. There was a conclusion that there was a very small effect on intelligence, that it might lower intelligence by a measurable but very small amount in terms of IQ scores.
One of the interesting things I know about India and southern parts of India where the concentration of fluoride in the water is very high, the traditional South Indian cuisine uses tamarind. Tamarind binds fluoride. It prevents the absorption of fluoride from the water. After the British came, people started using tomatoes instead of tamarind, and so it wasn't binding the fluoride as well. Problems from excess fluoride were happening at a higher rate.
I did not know that.
It's interesting how local cultures can find ways to adapt to things, perhaps without the basic science research, but some symbiosis.
Yeah, that's interesting. I have to research that myself now.
I really appreciate you explaining the chemistry and physiology and toxicology of fluoride. We're running way out of time, and we're not going to be able to talk about the controversies and the politics around the fluoridation of municipal water supplies. And I really had wanted to talk to you about that. Perhaps we could talk another time. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
there is going to be a change in the recommended fluoride level for water fluoridation. Currently, I said it was one part per billion. It's actually a range dependent upon the climate. Based on studies in the 50s that children consume more water in hot climates because they're thirstier. Current research shows that children, regardless of climate, consume about the same amount of water and beverages now. Sedentary lifestyles, watching TV screens or computer modules or whatever, not running around outside as much as they used to.
And air conditioning.
Air conditioning, heating. We've standardized our climates across the whole of the United States. The recommendation now is to go to the lower end of the range that used to be 0.7 to 1.2 is for everybody now to be at 0.7. The WHO has adopted a maximum level for naturally occurring fluoride of 1.5 parts per million. We're moving in the direction of accepting the fact that people are using fluoride toothpaste. Kids are swallowing that. We've recognized that there's an increasing prevalence of dental fluorosis. There's also a decline in tooth decay.
That's great. Part of the decline in tooth decay may also just be socioeconomic status.
It's always better to be born to more affluent parents.
At least in terms of your teeth. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you, Professor Pollack. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, too. Appreciate it.
That was Dr. Howard Pollack, Professor of Preventive and Restorative Dentistry at the University of California, San Francisco, and Chair of the California Fluoridation Advisory Council. Tick at the gadding in a ta, take at the gadding in a ta, cut the gadding in a ta, 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 gadding in a